Hi everyone, it's Kino here. Thanks so much for joining me on Seek Up, the Yoga Inspiration Show. I am so grateful for you and grateful to you for tuning in and sharing this journey with me. I am overwhelmed with how many people come up to me and say that they're really enjoying this type of communication, teaching, and sharing. So thank you so much for being a part of this journey of yoga, this journey of spirituality, this journey of mindfulness, this journey of seeking wisdom. More than anything else, this is meant to support the seeker's journey, meant to support you on the path. If you find this series of teaching really beneficial, the way that you can support this series is to become a member of the Om Stars yoga community and practice. We have decided to make this series free and available to everyone so that no matter where you are in the world, you can get the teachings that will hopefully provide sustenance for the seeker's journey. And for those of you that can become a member and give your support, please know that I appreciate it. And I'll see you on the mat real soon. It was really nice to share the practice this morning with everyone. There are some students who are very familiar with the Ashtanga method, some who are newer to the Ashtanga method, and some who took a little hiatus and are on the way back to the Ashtanga method. And it was so nice to see such dedication and enthusiasm for the practice. And we also remember that one practice is just a drop in the ocean of how many practices we have as potential in our lives. So in regards to Ashtanga yoga, this is not a once-off experience, but something that we commit to doing as a daily discipline in our lives. And the benefit of the practice kind of increases exponentially as we continue to do the practice. In fact, Ashtanga yoga is so difficult, we could say, that to do it once a week or to do it sporadically actually is pretty horrible. Because we need to develop a foundation of what the method is about. To jump in and experience it, it's completely fine. But to keep the consistency of the practice is really where the sort of inner work starts to happen, starts to unfold. And this is where the practice can transform you. That being said, the intensity of the practice like we've done this morning might not be something that's available to you every day. And so doing the practice every day, or in the Ashtanga tradition, 6 days a week, does not mean doing your maximum every single day. We always want to have the ability to get on the mat and see what happens, so that each time we step on the mat, it counts as a practice. Even if you stood on your mat and then the body waged a protest. I don't know if you've ever had a situation like that where you thought, I'm going to practice today, and the body said, no, you're not. You know, maybe you had the flu, or maybe you were so sore because of some other activity that you've done the day before, or you were just too tired. Something like that. So that counts because you stood on the mat and you tried. And maybe instead of the rigorous asanas, you just stood there for a little bit and then decided to lie down. And that's okay too. It's the continuity of touching the practice space every day where the magic of the practice starts to happen. There is something to be said of the difficulty of the traditional Ashtanga yoga method, in that we're not really meant to experience it as a once-off sort of, once-off sort of activity. The best way that this method works is if we can take little bites and let our bodies and our minds and our emotions digest those little bites. And then when we're ready for a second serving, then we get a second serving. But sometimes it can feel overwhelming if we bite off too much. And then we feel completely almost, we feel like drowning in the method. So those of you who are newer to the practice, recognize that it has been a lot already, and that this level is not what you would want to take away and integrate into creating a sustainable practice. If we're newer to the Ashtanga yoga method, no matter if you've done another style of yoga, So sometimes people say, oh, yes, but I've been doing Hatha Yoga for 5 years. Oh, but I've been doing Vinyasa Flow for 5 years. I've been doing this and that. And Ashtanga Yoga is different because there's a different demand and a different methodology. Because we use the asanas as a doorway to spiritual transformation, those same asanas that we may do in another format have a different charge to them. So when we're starting off with the practice, it's important to bite off only so much as we can chew and digest and really integrate. And then the same thing is true as we continue the practice, because at some moment it starts to look exciting to try to have more. You know, somehow the mindset of more starts to come into the practice. You know, more poses. We see someone else who has more poses than we have, and we think, oh, maybe I should get some of those. You know, so then we ask our teacher, hey, can I do those? And depending on who your teacher is, you may hear yes or you may hear no, you know, or we'll see, you know. So there's actually quite a funny story that Chatterjee shared this past time while we were in India. And he said that when his grandfather went away, his uncle was teaching. And there was a man who was practicing who was obsessed with more asanas. He just constantly wanted more asanas. But he was a little intimidated of Patabi Joyce. So he asked like, sporadically. But as soon as Patabi Joyce left and his son was teaching, immediately, hey, can you give me some new asanas? I want some new asanas. Give me new asanas. Give me new asanas. But his grandfather, or his father, Patabi Joyce, had told him specifically, don't give this guy any new asanas. He's always asking for asanas and he can't do what he has and he's going to harm himself. Like, let's not. And then immediately, you know, the guru is gone, and now let's try to get some asanas. So every day he asks, every day he asks, every day he asks. And so then, Patabi Joyce Guruji's son finally came up and said, okay, I'm going to give you an asana. And he said, lie on your side and put your head in your hand and breathe 5 times. And then lie on your other side and put your head in the other hand and breathe 5 times. And do that before you take rests. And this is a good asana for you. And he did it very seriously. Oh, this is my new asana. Wow. It's even one I've never seen anyone else doing. This must be something really special for me. So he took it with a lot of devotion and a lot of dedication. And then, you know, Patabi Joyce came back and was like, what's this guy doing? You know, why is he lying like this and lying like that with such intensity? And then finally his son had to come up and say, well, you know, I had to give him something because he was basically harassing me every day that you were gone for some new asana. So I told him to lie like this and lie like that and breathe 5 times each side. And then, you know, his father said, okay, let him do that. It won't harm him. So even though sometimes we think that the teacher is strict or mean sometimes, the teacher is always ideally looking out for us, having the question, will this asana crush the student? Will this asana harm the student? Is this practice more than they can take on? Or is this practice something that they can take on? And that question always sits in the teacher's mind evaluating, what's this person's body like? What's this person's mind like? How is it that they're showing up? Do they have humility? Do they have ego? Do they have desire? Do they have disregard for the practice? And so all of these questions come into the equation when we're really asked to consider what is the best practice for us. And the importance of having a teacher that we work with can't be overstated, because if we're just meant to figure it out on our own, it's very likely that we'll choose something that's either too much or too little for us. Usually we vacillate on the extremes of taking on too much because we think it's exciting, or we have our self-worth tied to what the body looks like or what the body can do or it cannot do, or we don't believe in ourselves enough and so we do too little. We think, oh, I can't, you know, and we just do too little. So having a teacher is really important to kind of bring that light into places that we can't see within ourselves. And sometimes it doesn't feel good to be told, no, you know, no, you're not ready for that one yet. No, we'll have to see how this other thing goes. Or sometimes it also doesn't feel good to hear, try this thing you're terrified of, you know, do this thing that you think is impossible. That also feels a little confrontational. So Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, he's a Tibetan teacher. He's written some really amazing books, no longer with us. Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism is a really wonderful book that he wrote. And he talked about the way that people who are not raised within a spiritual lineage create a kind of objectification of the practice that they're given. And they focus on the material elements of it rather than the inner elements of that. And for example, he was teaching people traditional Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhist meditation, and he found that his students became obsessed with their cushions, you know? They just became obsessed. What type of cushion, you know, what color the cushion is, how soft it is, what shape it is, where it is in the room. So they were obsessed with their cushions. And he felt that this was a form of materialism. You know, like this is it's really irrelevant what type of cushion you're on. It can be a fancy cushion. It can be a horrible cushion. It can be all types of, it can be no cushion. But still we should have the practice should be occurring within us. When the material kind of, when the materiality of the form of whatever it is that we're doing starts to place, have preeminence within our understanding of what the practice is, this is when we need a teacher to guide us back. Now, I never met Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, but I met people who practiced with him, and they said that he changed their life, you know, but often it was with a lot of struggle, you know, and his one of his famous quotes is that a spiritual teacher's role is to insult you, you know, and you think like, wow, that sounds awful, you know, why would I be around someone that's going to insult me? Well, he was also someone that was kind of a bit edgy, and he would do things that would break people's boxes of what, you know, what spirituality was. So he would often, I think that he didn't smoke, but then sometimes he would start off a lecture and he would smoke just to confuse people a little bit and say, oh, you know, someone can be spiritual who's smoking. Someone can be spiritual who, you know, doesn't fit our box about that. Eckhart Tolle, he says that when he started to become more known as a spiritual teacher, he used to have to put glasses and a hat on when he went to buy a cup of coffee because people would come up to him and go, oh, aren't you Eckhart Tolle? You wrote this like book about now and now you're drinking coffee. How is that about presence? You know, you're accelerating, you know, caffeine is not about presence. And he's like, I just like coffee. I'm going to put the hat so he would hide himself so he could go get coffee in peace, you know? So that's the material elements of what we think someone should be when they step onto the path. When we're focusing on that, it's like focusing on the cushion. Now, that being said, what we take as an insult sometimes is not meant as an insult, right? So sometimes our teacher is giving us some advice that we have a reaction to, and we take it as an insult. You know, for example, I don't think you're strong enough for that pose yet. Can be taken as, my teacher called me weak. And did that actually happen, or did we just feel insulted in that moment? You know, I don't think your mind is stable enough yet. Turns into my teacher thinks I'm dumb. So how we process things and the story we tell around things is often where that insult becomes, because we have this idea of who we are and what we think we should have. You know, I should be doing this amount of poses. I shouldn't have to be forced to do things I don't. You know, that I feel are too much, something like that. And then when we're confronted with aspects of ourself that we're not resolved about yet, this can often feel like an insult. It can often feel like an uncomfortable challenge, all right? Now, that being said, we don't want to empower everybody that's done, you know, a 200-hour, 300-hour teacher training to go around and be like, I'm going to go insult all my students. No, that's not what I'm saying by any means. It's that at some moment when someone has been teaching for a long time, they have an immense amount of experience about what can work for different students. And sometimes that information is not what the student wants to hear. So sometimes when we have yoga outside of spiritual lineages and we're teaching people that are not raised within a spiritual lineage, we have yoga as a kind of service. Yoga as a function of the spa, yoga as a function of hospitality, or yoga as a function of fitness. And what we have to remember is that yoga is a spiritual discipline, particularly the lineage-based practices, that have as their goal not so much your physical health, not so much your temporary happiness, not so much your customer service experience, but has at its goal your spiritual transformation, so that there's something inside that happens. And we need, and sometimes when we go inside, we experience the shadow side of ourselves. So the practice and the teacher, especially someone that's been teaching in the spiritual practice for a long time, has to be brave enough and willing enough to deliver sometimes uncomfortable truths, you know? And not be worried about the sort of customer service implications of that. At the same time, I do genuinely believe in trying to speak with as much compassion as possible. We have the idea of, you know, truthfulness without compassion is just can be quite mean and cold. And in the teaching of Vipassana, which is the meditation practice that I've been sitting for over 20 years, there's this idea that all of our practice and all of our teaching should always be balanced between wisdom and compassion. Because if wisdom is present without compassion, it can be cold and even come off mean and too impersonal. But if there's only compassion, then we can enable behaviors that are no longer wise. We can, encourage mindsets that no longer serve oneself or the students or the community. So we have to find that balance within ourselves. And ultimately, that balance is what creates a really grounded spiritual lineage. So we want to understand the difference between the way we may have understood yoga as a fitness practice, the way we may have understood yoga as, a health-based practice, and open our minds a little bit to yoga as a spiritual practice. The confusing point is that there is the physical discipline of asana that many people are drawn to that is a wonderful foundation for the spiritual practice. But we can't confuse asana as the goal of the spiritual practice, that it is a tool that's used within the wider framework of some sort of inner transformation, you know? And if we only judge our success on the practice of yoga by what asanas we can or cannot do, then we unfortunately can create a false hierarchy of the poses. And many people do this when they first start practicing. I did it myself, you know? We see someone with both legs behind the head and we think, wow, they must be very spiritual, you know? Right? We see someone with a very deep backbend and we think, ooh, the kundalini must be really awake in there. And we don't know what kundalini is. We don't even know what spirituality is at that moment. But that's essentially the naivete of beginning there. And that's totally fine. After a few years of practice, we want to expand our notion of what the yoga method is about, right? And we want to try to understand, what am I doing these asanas for? Am I just doing these asanas for more asanas? You know, we need to try to understand what is the reason that I do these asanas. And sometimes it's not immediately obvious when we start grasping for reasons. Oh, I generally feel better after. I don't know. I generally feel, I'm not sure how, but after these few years, I'm a nicer person. I'm not really sure how that works, you know? And we want to really, really start to understand that the asanas work places in the body-mind-spirit connection that our rational minds won't always be able to understand. So sometimes we want to know a definitive answer, you know? Is this good for me? Is this good for me? Should I do this pose? Should I do this backbend? Should I do these powerful lift-ups? Should I force myself to bind this pose or that pose? These sorts of things. And we have to remember that the asana practice is for you to figure out day by day, what do I feel? What's right for me? How's this working for me? How is my breathing? What are the sensations I have inside? And then each time we leave the mat, we want to have instant feedback like that. Every practice we feel takes us a little bit further within the spiritual path, which does not mean that it always feels like progress. And that's something hard to understand, because sometimes we grow the most when things are difficult. You know, we grow the most when we feel a little down. And this is something that I noticed with progressive multiple trips to India to practice with my teachers, is that whenever I arrived and I felt kind of high on myself, oh, I feel so wonderful. Look, I've I was once weak, now I'm strong, you know? And I felt like, wow, this is wonderful. And I had this attitude of, I'm somebody. Then that trip was extremely difficult for me because I don't know how they knew, but they knew that that was my attitude. And then every day, then I was doing something wrong. And it wasn't always some asana that was wrong. My mat was in the wrong place. You know, Kino, don't put your mat there. Why did you do that? Put it over here. Oh, okay. The next day I put my mat there. This is the wrong place for your mat. Go put it over there. Well, I was there yesterday. You told me to move here. Go over there. Okay. I don't say anything. I just go over there. Every day, some problem. Oh, you're late today. Why are you late? I'm actually early, but okay. Apparently I'm late. The next day I came at the right, what I thought was the right time. And then why are you early? You're so early. You know, you're early. Okay, wait. During one of these trips, I had this thing with the time I was supposed to come to practice because I wasn't in the first group. I was in the second group. And then I was late one day and the next day I was early. And then I was early and then I was late. And then I was early and then I was asked to wait 2 hours to practice. Then I just like sat there and was like, I was really on time, but okay. And there was nothing to do but just sit there. And it was difficult, you know. I saw these people going in and I thought, definitely it's my time to practice. And I would stand up and they would say, not yet. Not yet. You sit there. Sit there. I'm getting hungry at this point. Is there going to come somebody with chai or something? Because at this point, I need like a little something, you know? So now it starts to be like 4 hours since I woke up. And there's numerous other difficulties. But I learned so much from that. And you could, and then from the outside, if you were, you know, from outside the spiritual lineage, if you were teaching a class and you had a student that came and was like really, really high on themselves and, you know, they came and they thought they were amazing and you're teaching, you know, how do we interact with that when we don't have kind of the, you know, the tools of the spiritual lineage at our disposal? It's quite difficult, you know? We think, oh goodness, because we're, you know, we very much outside of you know, the main leaders of various lineages, we're all kind of equals on the path. And so we don't really want to claim some, you know, mantle of trying to be a mini guru. At the same time, if we've been practicing for a while, we may have insights that are very relevant that may be uncomfortable to deliver. So there's a fine line to walk between that, I think. And it's something that's worthy of every teacher's consideration. You know, when am I compromising the lineage to try to keep the students and please the students? When am I people pleasing in what I'm teaching? And when am I willing to, as Patavi Joyce said, teach only that one student who connects with what I'm doing, you know? That's difficult because then there's all sorts of things, especially if teaching is your livelihood. You're like, oh, I can teach one student, but then what do I tell my landlord, you know? Oh, I'm trying to keep so true to the spiritual lineage so that now nobody comes, right? So there's some balance, I think, between how we understand yoga to be presented in the lexicon of fitness and spa services and hospitality services and authenticity that is really where the magic of the practice happens. So when we take on the mantle of somehow joining a traditional lineage, and we can do that in numerous ways. We can be teaching, and I know many of you are teaching. And we can also be students of the lineage. And when we're students of the lineage, it's also our responsibility to learn as much as possible about the history, about where it comes from, and about how we can show up in such a way so that we support the community. And not everyone will serve the lineage by being a teacher. Sometimes, and very, 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 very often, the people who serve the best are the most enthusiastic, dedicated, sincere students of the lineage, you know? So we have to understand that this practice that we've been given, that many of us have been practicing for a long time, and some of us who are newer into this practice, is a truly sacred gift, that there is an element of grace about you being here right now. Out of the multitudes of activities available today, this morning, you chose to come here and practice. So we understand that that itself is a grace. Out of the multitudes of opportunities to interact with yoga, you're here practicing a traditional method. It's wonderful. So that in itself, again, is a grace. Many people don't interface with a traditional method of yoga. And maybe their only opportunity to practice is something that is, more like contemporary calisthenics, something more like flexibility training or strength training, which are all wonderful and I really enjoy. But something different happens when you make contact with the traditional lineage and you have the grace to have that placed in front of you. And then your role is to say yes, to say, yeah, I want to do that. Yes, absolutely. Something in you rises up and says, yes, absolutely, I want to do that. Out of the multitudes of things that are available, I'm doing this class. And then I'm going to do it again the next day, and again the next day, and again the next day. And if you have the energy and enthusiasm to do the practice, this is one of the best things that you can do to continue in service of the lineage. So many people start off with enthusiasm and then it dies, you know? And it dies often because either they weren't willing to accept some uncomfortable truths, they weren't willing to, do the work, because at some moment it's exhausting to get up and continue practicing, or they ultimately didn't have a teacher that was available to guide them into some of the more subtle aspects of the practice, right? So I've seen people with a lot of enthusiasm start and then burn out. And my wish for each of you is that that's not you. So whatever you can do to constantly reconnect to the traditional lineage, to constantly get a little bit more spark for the inner journey of the practice. When you feel yourself wavering, see how you can come back. When you find yourself judging yourself because you can't do this pose, you have to modify that pose. This one, you don't feel that you've gotten enough asanas or something like that, go back to, well, wait a minute. What am I doing this practice for? Is it for more poses? You know, a friend of mine, we were talking on one trip to Mysore where everybody was just obsessed with, you know, trying to get some new pose, you know? And she said, I don't understand why we think more is better, you know? And I asked her what she meant. And she said, I don't understand why people think more is better. Better is better. You know, if we can do what we do better, that's enough. You know, at some moment, we realize also that the familiarity of the ordinary poses, so the longer you've been practicing, the more the sun salutations and the standing poses begin to be almost ordinary. You know, we do them, we're familiar with them. And the danger with that is that we can be mindless in our doing of poses that are so familiar to ourselves. And there's something, there's some learning that can happen when we do the familiar with constant awareness of fresh eyes, you know. Every sun salutation is different. Every time I do the standing poses is different. And this is a great, you know, the thing with, you know, with any spiritual discipline will contain vast troves of wisdom that we can apply into our lives. Right? There's so much of our lives that we take as ordinary and we disregard. So much of our lives that it's just the same thing that we do every day that we disregard. Until one day, that thing which we didn't pay attention to is not there. And then suddenly we realize how special it was that whatever that thing was there every day. Maybe we live with someone who makes us tea or coffee in the morning and we don't realize that they do that they do for themselves and they make a little extra for us as well. And then one day that person's not there. And then we realize, oh, wow, that person gave to me in such a way that nourished me and I didn't even realize it at the time. But now I miss that. And so that's something like that appreciation for the everyday ordinary moments that fill our lives is there for us when we come and we stand on our mats and we do Surya Namaskar again, we do that same old sun salutation again. And we realize, oh, this is giving to us. This practice is actually giving to us. Those foundational things are giving to us far beyond, what those crazy looking cool poses for Instagram are. But it's actually the nourishment that we take from the basics, the foundation, is where we lay the firm ground of the practice, you know? So every practice that we do should allow us to have some kind of self-knowledge, self-learning. And this is where we have this concept of self-realization, which has been turned into, you know, a big lofty goal that like one day only a select few will attain. But it's not like that at all. Every time we realize a little bit more of who we are, every time we step off the mat and we set down a little bit of anger, we set down a little bit of self-directed negativity, we set down a little bit of anxiety, and we see a little bit clearly, a little bit more clearly. In that way, we are more realized about the self. The same thing with samadhi. We think samadhi is some mythical realm reserved for the enlightened masters, and that only those, you know, precious few will ever touch samadhi. But the idea of samadhi is a state of connection with the infinite that everyone has experienced. But even people that don't practice yoga have experienced. Now, the difference between the spiritual practitioner and someone that doesn't have a spiritual practice, when they experience samadhi, it's considered to be, you know, a life-changing epiphany moment, you know? Some knowledge or insight came out of the blue because for whatever reason, maybe the wind was blowing in a particular way, the sunlight was hitting in a very particular way, and the body felt good for some reason, and everything aligned, and then poof, they realized something about themselves. Wow, whole life can change in a moment with that. Now, the yoga practitioner, the meditator, the spiritual practitioner, you have moments like this, so many moments like this, that we've lost count, you know? So many moments. Oh, some realization. Oh, and then we made a life change. Another realization, another life change. Even a simple thought that we realize, oh, I'm actually really hard on myself. It's a life-changing epiphany. And then we wake up from that. And then we realize again, oh, I don't try hard enough. I quit before I try. It's another life-changing epiphany. I meet so many people that change their whole lives after they start practicing yoga, you know? And whether it's changing the job or showing up in a different way or just making different decisions. We talked a lot about this over the last couple of days that very often many people make diet changes when they start practicing yoga. And that, you know, we have to eat multiple times throughout the day. So as soon as you change your diet, you've changed your life. Whether we like it or not. When I started practicing, nobody warned me that, you know, there were going to be all these momentous life changes. And David Swensen, he has a funny way of saying that where he says, don't let yoga ruin your life. Because it's almost like a warning that we should have to students. Like, are you sure you're ready for this? You know, you're going to get hooked on this and your whole life is going to change. And there'll be so many small changes along the path that you'll look back 10 years from now and you might not even recognize who you were, you know? And we don't realize that. We're just like, I came because I wanted to do a headstand. And then suddenly we're changing our diet. We're going to bed at a new time. Suddenly, you know, we're changing alcohol for kombucha, you know? We're like, oh, that was great. You know, we go to bed early instead of going to bed very late, and all of our friends change. And there's a whole host of life changes that we weren't warned about when we came in and we signed the waiver. You know, if you sign a waiver to go into the most yoga centers, did you all sign a waiver to be present at some moment? We do that here in the United States. We sign waivers like crazy. I mean, also because, I don't know, it's like the lawsuit capital of the world. It's like you can sneeze and someone can sue you. You've sneezed, you know, on me. It's a negative impact. Anyhow, we have all these waivers, but the waiver is very extensive legally, but it doesn't actually include what you're going to end up giving up, you know, like that. But it should also say, be prepared for radical life change. And you should sign that also. So it says all sorts of things like, you know, I won't sue you if this happens, that happens. But there should be a line, and maybe I'll add it for fun, you know, be prepared to change your entire life. Everything will shift. And I think that that's something we don't necessarily realize. And at the same time, to look and see all of the life changes that happen when we practice yoga is a testament to that yoga works. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we have this practice today is yet another testament that yoga works to bring about some state of samadhi, some state of self-realization. Because there wouldn't be an unbroken lineage of students and teachers that have kept this teaching alive for thousands of generations within India had the practice itself not been successful at delivering on its promise of creating a mind that is more peaceful, creating a life which is filled with more truthfulness and wisdom and compassion. So when you doubt, and we will all doubt at some moment the method of yoga, when we doubt ourselves or when we doubt the method, remember that people just like us were practicing thousands of years ago, that everyone feels the same things that are on the path. And remember that this is not something that's newly been invented, but the deeper aspect of the yoga practice has been around for thousands of generations. We can rely on a time-tested method to bring us into more peace and more happiness. And really the only thing that is required on that path is that we show up. That's really all that matters. And the only way that yoga works for us is if we do it. And if we don't do it, then it immediately stops working. All right. So we don't have to do it well, and that's important. So we don't have to do it by anyone else's standards, but we need to do the practice in some capacity. And then it will work. And what's the evidence of yoga working? Not that we can put both legs behind the head, necessarily. Not that we can do a crazy lift up. Not that, you know, our back bending is the deepest in the whole world. Not like that. None of that is the promise of yoga. Yoga is promising something deeper, that we'll be happier, we'll be kinder, we'll be able to live with more self-realization, we'll be able to experience more states of samadhi in our life. So I want to share with you one of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, and then we'll have a little bit of some time for questions. So in the Ashtanga Yoga method, Patanjali defines this as a continual practice of the eight limbs. So not just asana, but we need the complete aspect of the moral and ethical principles of living the yogi life. We need to be understanding to work with the subtle aspects of the mind. We need to be working with the breath. We need to be understanding the totality of what it means to practice. Patanjali says, yogang anushtanad, the continual practice of the eight limbs of yoga. Yogang anushtanad, ashadik syaye. And this is the idea that when we light that spark of fire within us, that spark of fire is meant to go and seek out impurities. And what are the impurities? All the places we're not yet resolved about ourselves. All the places where we're holding on to anger, hatred, animosity, ill will, all the tightness. Every place we have anxiety and fear. All the places of irresolution. All the places where we're not whole yet. And so that light, Ashadik Jaye, is meant to go in and find all those places within ourselves. And so it's already understand that this is difficult, you know? It's not promising immediately you're going to feel good. It's no, the continual practice will shine light on all the impurities. The impurities are not to be taken as, a moral judgment, but because we all have them. It's the idea that we all have hatred, anger, animosity. We all have places of ego and hubris and pride and arrogance and places of ignorance and places of fear and anxiety, and those are our impurities. So that light, that fire will go in and seek for the right kindling, you know, the right stuff to burn, right? Yoganga nushtanad ashadiksyaye, jnana diptir, after many years of practice, then that process of purification will lead us into a state of knowledge where the light, where the fire will light a lamp of knowledge within ourselves. So that's the idea of a light, you could say, like a literal light, meaning that there's more light within us, meaning there's less confusion, there's less darkness, there's less ignorance, there's less anger, animosity, hatred, because that lamp of knowledge is lit within us, not outside of ourselves, right? So, yoganga nushtanad ashadiksyaye jnana diptir, avivekakyatehe. So, avivekakyati, Viveka is wisdom, and Kathy is discriminative discernment. And this is very important to understand that what we use the light for is important in the practice of Ashtanga Yoga. That we're not just there to sort of self-illuminate and get high on ourselves. Oh, look, I'm so realized. You know, oh, wow, I'm a big light. No, not like that. But the idea of Viveka Kyati is that we are trying to shine a light into the darkness so that we can be able to discriminate between what is untrue and what is true, between what is the path, what is not the path, between what is the true self and what is the false self, between what is eternal and what is not eternal, what lasts forever and what only comes and goes. Because when we can't see that, this is what's called the root of avidya, or the root of ignorance. And as long as we're lost in the darkness of ignorance, then we're spinning storms of delusion, leading to anger, hatred, animosity, pride, arrogance, attachment to the false self, anxiety, fear, depression, and all sorts of things that are really only generated because our minds are not able to see clearly. You might for a moment think back to some time in your life where maybe there was something that you were not willing to see for whatever reason. Maybe you were not willing to accept some difficult truths. Maybe we, in fact, made a mistake. I don't know if you've ever made some. Probably you also have made some mistakes. Yes? You know, like we did something and we realized after, ooh, that was bad. I should not have done that. Maybe we got swindled by someone, you know, or we made we bought some product that we thought was good and it was not. Or we trusted someone we shouldn't have trusted. And sometimes it takes us a while to admit, oh, actually, I was in delusion. Oh, I was in avidya. I was not in my intelligence. Maybe we even injured ourselves in the practice and we didn't want to admit that. And instead we blamed the practice. Instead we blamed other people. Oh, it's the mat that was too slippery. You know, it's the mat's fault. I hate these mats. You know, sometimes we blame the teacher even though the teacher might not have even touched us that day. You know, oh, if they weren't there, I wouldn't have been injured. We did it to ourselves sometimes. It happens all the time. You know, we hatch some idea today, I'm going to do something. And then, you know, well, for whatever reason, it didn't work out. We weren't sensitive enough. Admitting that requires us to move from avidya into viveka kyati, you know, to admit and say, I made a mistake. Because as soon as we recognize that, it forces us to root our sense of self in something which is beyond the mistake, beyond the struggle, beyond the negative consequences of our course of action. And then we have, instead of hubris or pride, we have humility. And we can start to walk back the path of whatever it is we took. So we can start to understand, well, why is it that this injury came? Why is it that I trusted this person I shouldn't have trusted? Why is it that this happened? You know, why didn't I listen to myself? We'll look back and we'll see, oh, there were a bunch of red flags. Oh, that day I injured myself. I was pushing too hard. I didn't give myself a break for a long time. I didn't listen to the body. I was tuned into something else. And, you know, we often have a pull towards being out of the state of wisdom, which is why we have to come back to the practice. So yogang anushtanat, we have to find the way to practice again so that we can then let the practice spark the fire of burning through those impurities. And we can make peace with our mistakes, our shortcomings, and then find the light of knowledge. Oh, I'm so glad I made that mistake. Look what it taught me when I relearned. Oh, look, then we can find the wisdom, the compassion, you know, to forgive ourselves for those moments of mindlessness. And we can instead, you know, start to cultivate more mindfulness. So when we have doubt on the practice, remember, yogang anushtanat, I have to practice the eight limbs. And I have to be willing to let that fire search out my own impurities, to the degree to which I can surrender all of those states of impurity into the fire. To that degree, jnana diptir, the light of knowledge, will grow within me, and I will be able to see more clearly. There'll be less parts of myself I don't know about. There'll be less parts of myself that have been kind of relegated to a place of rejection, and there'll be more wholeness. Nowhere does it say you're going to put both legs behind your head. You know, nowhere does it say you're going to jump back beautifully. But the effort of trying should light the spark of, you know, the spark of that fire that will burn through our impurities. And I've talked for a long time. So are there any questions? Penny, you have a question? Sure. Oh, yeah. This is in book two. It's the beginning of the Ashtanga Yoga Sutra. So it's right before... right before Patanjali talks about each of the eight limbs and elaborates on what each of the benefits of the eight limbs are. It's like just before the middle of book two. The number off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. To what extent is yoga an individual practice? And how much of it is with engaging with the wider community? Like, I mean, you've been on tour, these are places which have almost like illiberal democracies and stuff. Mm. So to what extent does yoga think about this about an individual transformation? How much of it is about wider social political?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question. So, how much of yoga is an individual practice versus how much of yoga is involved in a larger cultural moment of a political process? So the first thing to understand is that yoga is always first and foremost an individual practice. That the individual practice is the foundation of everything else. Without the individual practice, there is no hope of any sort of, you know, political, community, global transformation. And there are many ungrounded attempts, meaning not grounded in personal practice, ungrounded attempts to change the world. People that don't have a personal practice, that are out there fighting for peace. We can already see the issue with fighting for peace, right? We're fighting. We've made a war for peace. So the idea is that it is our personal practice that must create the foundation for everything else. The idea being that when we are in avidya, when we are in ignorance, and every time we experience hatred, animosity, ill will, yoga says that we are in ignorance. We have not seen the truth of the situation clearly. It doesn't mean that harm has not been done. It doesn't mean that there isn't some course of action that should be taken to make the world a better place. But when we have lost ourselves, yoga says we are not seeing the situation clearly. In modern sort of contemporary psychological terms, the sort of way that that's presented is when we're not in self, when we are not calm and balanced, when we are triggered, then all of the actions we take when we're in that state of fight, flight, or freeze will have the energy of, of the trigger. Whereas if we wait until we're calm and balanced and we see clearly, actions that we take will have the energy of calm and balance. Now, that being said, the idea is that, I mean, the dream, you could say, is that if with enough people practicing, that there's more truth, more compassion, more wisdom in the world, and that we reach some sort of a critical mass of awakening where the world wakes up in some capacity, where there's more self-realization in the world, where there's more samadhi, where there's more, compassion and wisdom. No? However, without the foundation of personal practice, this begins to be very, very difficult. And we have the idea that there are also two paths that are given to us within, within the yoga teaching. So there's the path of the realized master who is removed from the world. There's a particular term for this, but I'm not remembering it right now. But there's a particular path of a realized master who removes themselves from the world, and then they go and enter into deep states of meditation and do practices like. On long retreats, 20-year retreats, 30-year retreats, these sorts of things, and they're not engaging with the world, but they're helping the world by crafting a path forward and charting uncharted territories so that they're almost like a beacon or a signal to emit a frequency of whatever state they're in the surrounding area, and that they hold the potential of what we may reach someday. Now, this is the path that goes away from society. There's another path that goes in society. And the path that's in society, they say, is harder. Because when you remove yourself from all distraction and go exclusively on the spiritual path, you stay in the cave, you do a long retreat. There are no family members to disturb you. You know, that what they say about that the guru is never a guru in their home. You know, so when we think about the path of being in the world, we realize that it is more difficult. And there's a path of a yogi in the world who must continue to practice and continue to interact with the difficulties and the hardships of the world and continue to practice and figure out how to respond as a yogi in that moment, which means to always go back to how can I maintain my own balanced, calm mind and only act when my mind is in citta vritti nirodha. When I am triggered, when I am saying this person is evil, then I'm triggered, I'm not calm. As soon as I can have compassion for that person, as soon as I can see, oh, they're suffering as well, then some action that could truly be of service in the betterment of society is possible. Unfortunately, there's so much hardship in the world. You know, we can look at the world and think, you know, and have our hearts break for so much. You know, suffering beings are innumerable on this planet. And we can be moved to try to go and alleviate the suffering of all these beings. It is wonderful to feel that kind of pull towards compassion. And at the same time, without our personal practice, we can just be spinning more misery. So the idea is that whatever action is taken is always grounded in our personal practice so that we begin to be more effective at actually evoking the change that we seek, whatever that is. And we recognize that, you know, our path is unique to us. So someone may have a very strong pull to clean the rivers, you know, of plastic. And we realize, oh, this is creating so much suffering on the planet for so many reasons. And they have a pull to give of service in that way. The more that that person practices, the more clear they are in their spiritual practice, the more effective they're going to be at executing their mission. Then it's very easy in our contemporary age because we have all of the, you know, the stories of all of the suffering of our planet and all the people and the beings of our planet available to us in our little rectangular phone. And it's very easy to see someone who's doing really good work, like cleaning a river in Bali, for example. And they're taking out, you know, 2 million kilograms of plastic. And it's very easy to look at them and say, oh, what are you doing about the river in Malaysia? You know, it's very, and this is something that's called whataboutism. And it's very easy to kind of go and say, oh, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? Oh, you're giving water to orphans. You know, you're giving water to orphans in Nepal. Well, what about the orphans in Bangladesh? I'm like, yeah, I'll get there as soon as possible. So we have to remember, again, to respect our path and respect other people's paths with the hope that the more people practice, the more effective they'll be at working with wisdom and compassion. Sometimes what we think is compassion actually creates more suffering. Sometimes what we think is wisdom is actually ignorance. So the more we practice, the more we'll see that more and more clearly.
So does this mean you find compassion in anyone? Like a warmonger?
Yeah, I really appreciate this.
Right.
Yeah, I totally appreciate this question. And we didn't even talk about the sutra that talks about it. So now I'm going to have to talk about it. So Patanjali says that the yogi needs to create a state called citta prasadanam, right? Prasad is simultaneously a holy offering and a sweet and harmonious place or thing, a sweet and harmonious thing. So the yogi should have a mind that is citta prasadanam. If you've been to a temple, a traditional Indian temple or Hindu temple, you get prasad when you walk out. You ever tried? They don't give you a sweet. It's like a sweet thing. Yeah, the sweet. You're like, oh, no, thanks. Maybe you take it next time. You can take it next time and take a little bite and then you can give it to the, yeah, some little sweet. Yeah, you're like, ah. But the prasad is the holy offering. And it's a sweet. It's a sweetness. It contains a sweetness. So Patanjali says that the yogi should have citta prasadanam. And if we're not in that state, then we're not in the yogic mind. So the moment we look at a warmonger, for example, someone that's blowing up people and is like, oh, this person, they're horrible. We should blow them up also. You know, that's a reasonable thought on many levels, right? Like, look, they blew up all these people. Let's blow them up too. Now we are the warmonger. You don't know, we are blowing up someone, you know, even though it's justified, we could say. But if we are a yogi, we have to pause and say, wait a minute, as I hate this guy. As soon as you hate someone, we're no longer citta prasadanam. But if we realize, oh, look at this person who's blowing up everybody, what was their life like? What did they suffer? Oh, they've suffered. So they only know how to blow things up. So how can we stop them from blowing things up and try to show them some compassion? If they must be killed, how can they be killed with compassion, with zero hate in the heart of who needs to perform that execution? How can we maintain citta prasadanam even while doing things which are very difficult? This is an extremely challenging teaching, because the teaching is essentially, as long as you hate, we're not effective as yogis any longer. That doesn't mean we're not effective in the world. The world will feed your hate. You know, the world creates bandwagons of hate where you can jump on and you'll find evidence why it's justified and useful, and a whole community of people that will cheer you on in the hate. But that doesn't mean we're walking the yogi path. And we've all done it before. We've all done it. We've all hated. Me too. We've all jumped on various bandwagons of hate. We all even have just people that we just like to hate, you know, that we like hate follow them. Like, look at them. Like, oh, I hate them. You know, and it's just something we do as humans. Me too. But the idea is that our practice tries to make us work on our own hate, first and foremost. I mean, there's this idea of, you know, there's this very idealistic notion that the people who really need to be practicing yoga are all the leaders of the world and people in positions of power who have the wealth, money, and power to effect change. The people who are pulling the levers of power in the world, that they would be great if they were to practice the spiritual practice, not the let me stretch your hamstrings so I can like get your back feeling better practice, but the real spiritual practice. And really wake up from the delusion and do better in the world. You know, this is some ideal of you know, some world that doesn't exist just yet. Okay.
But doesn't this conflict with the, I remember there's this myth about this the warrior pose where this archer guy,
okay,
should I kill the Karen so that he stopped killing other people?
Yeah. Yeah, I love this. I'm going to call Arjuna this archer guy now. I like that. So Arjuna, this archer guy, that's his name, Arjuna. He's a warrior prince. Yeah, he's a warrior prince. And the entire teaching of what's called the Bhagavad Gita addresses what's called a dharma sankata. And a dharma sankata, so dharma is an action. Sankata is sort of irresolution. It's a difficult choice where there are no good outcomes. So the entire teaching of the Gita is about this dharma sankata. So here is Arjuna, who's a warrior prince. His dharma, his action in the world, is to be an archer. There's a battle that he must, because of his dharma, enter. And he must, because this is his job, his livelihood, his vocation, his calling in life, he must enter this war. This is a war that he didn't want, but it is a war that had to happen. So he had to go in. If he doesn't, he will not fulfill his life's destiny. So there's a whole. So he sits with the Dharma Sankata. And the Dharma Sankata is, look, I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to kill. I don't want to kill. I don't hate these people. They're my family members, as a matter of fact. This is my archery teacher. These are my friends that are on the other side. I don't want to kill them. And actually, do you know what Arjuna does? He quits. He says, I'm not doing it, buddy. I know you're God and all, and like you're all powerful, and like you came down specifically to be my guide and everything like that, and I'm supposed to listen to you and all that jazz, but you know what? No. You're going to find yourself some other dude to pull that bow, because I am not killing anybody. And then this teaching of how to be in the world but not of it is elaborated through the teaching of the Gita. And so I can recommend for you to read the Gita and go into this question of the Dharma Sankata. How do I take an action where there are no good choices? If I leave, then I will condemn my entire family to death. And I myself won't live. I will be pursued by the enemy until the end of the world, and I will die by their hand. And there will be no more descendants of my family. We will all die because I didn't show up. I have to show up. If I show up, I have to kill my archery teacher. kill my childhood friends, kill my uncle. I know, this is horrible. This is worse and worse. You know, this is worse and worse. So then Krishna says, I will show you how. This is the teaching of yoga. I will show you. You do like this. And this is essentially this teaching of how to take action from a place of resolution, where even though he has to kill these beings, he doesn't hate them when he's pulling the arrow. And he also doesn't attach to the goal specifically of killing. There's a particular notion of surrender that is taught very deeply in the Gita. And and Arjuna is given the instruction that he has to work very, very hard. He has to focus it with all his attention on his particular task. His task is to focus, pull that arrow, and release that arrow with an unwavering focus on the target. And then, in the moment he releases the bow, or the arrow from the bow, he's said to surrender that bow to God, to give it over to Krishna. You know, so it's not me any longer. Because he's very concerned about, you know, and now I will have killed. This is against the yogic principles. I will have killed. And Krishna says, if you surrender this to me and you're truly in the yogic state, it will not be you who is doing this, but it will be me through you who is doing this. At some moment, Arjuna asks a lot of really wonderful questions. I think he's a little forceful. He keeps asking questions. Wonderful. Without that, we wouldn't have the Gita. And at some moment, finally, he's like, okay, Krishna, you want me to do this and 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 this. What are you going to do? Huh? What are you going to do? You God over there? Right? What are you doing? I think it's a valid question. It's like slightly, you know, if you had a student that would, you know, you come in and you're like, you have to practice every day, you have to do this, you know, and the student's like, hey, what are you going to do? Well, do you know what he says? Does anybody know? He says, I will do the one thing you cannot do. I will still the wind. So your arrow will hit true. I will still the wind. So your arrow, your aim will be true. I will do the one thing you cannot do. And this is grace. So in the Dharma Sankhita, there's always an element of, am I clear enough to be in a state where I can receive grace? So if I'm angry, hating, I'm fighting, I'm in that state where I'm antagonistic towards myself or towards someone else, I'm not going to be open to receive that grace. So I can recommend you to read the Gita. I think the Gita is a wonderful, really, really, really wonderful teaching. Patabi Joyce used to recommend to read the Gita as a starting point for our journey in yoga philosophy. So I think with a really good commentary could be very helpful. You could start off academic if, you know, the Winthrop Sargent translation is very big, but it's very, 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 it's a really good translation. If you want just a faster translation, there's something called The Living Gita by Swami Satchidananda, I think, which is also quite nice. There's many, many translations and many commentaries that goes. I can recommend you to read that because it very much deals with this question of how do I maintain the yogic mind when I'm going to enter into a situation where there will be suffering, you know, and how do I act in that way? And he is a leader also. So he is a leader. He is the warrior prince that will be the determining factor in this great and epic battle. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, last one. Oh, I think we're over the time. Hmm. So is your question, you know, that the practice can be almost too stimulating, and what can we do to... Yeah, how to integrate that, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. So there's a couple of things. First of all, we're going to look at that in the next class, The Subtle Body. And then the second thing is to make sure that our practice isn't too much. So we only get overwhelmed like that where we can't lose our heat, we are feeling, you know, too much nervousness, this sort of thing, when maybe we're doing a little bit too much. And if we have a week or two where it's one new pose and we notice that our body is a little warmer, our nerves are a little more fried, that's okay. But if that state of being overheated and being overstimulated is a constant state, then we need to reevaluate our approach to the practice and maybe actually do less. Less asanas, more meditation. Less asanas, more breathing, and not the kumbhaka breaths, you know, just the more calming breathing.
And also, if someone's, let's say, the female students walk up to you and ask you, can I practice doing an expression? Because the ashram, yes, the pranic energy is like a pano, the pranic energy is like going downwards, but the udana, the anubana is going upwards. So we have, when we practice, it's literally like very intense on the breathing, the bandha. Yeah, so the question is that, what is the second
way? It's a good question. There is this question in Ashtanga Yoga for anyone that experiences, menstruation. Number one, you're advised not to practice during the menstruation period. No intensive asanas, especially not deep back bending. At least not during the days when it's heaviest. For numerous reasons, what you mentioned, that the flow is moving downward and we're not trying to disturb that. One of the second reasons I think we mentioned during the week is that the ileopsoas actually makes contact with the ovaries. So we don't have, and it's extremely impacted by the hormones. So we actually don't have good support of the core during the times, particularly of heaviest menstruation. So it's advised not to do Ashtanga yoga during that time. We're not trying to purify. So we can give an alternative practice. We can give meditation as a practice. We can give even Anulom Vilom, the alternate nostril breathing, as a practice. We can give yin as a practice during that time, something supportive, something calming, and something that actually provides a support for the body and mind during that time. We can also just advise the student to take at least one day off. This is also something that brings up stuff, you know? So we deliver some bad news. You know, oh, you're really enthusiastic, you want to practice, oh, you got your cycle. Well, take holiday. And, you know, people travel all the way to Mysore and practice. They go for a month. And then some people, they get ladies' holiday on, like, the second day of practice. And they're like, I quit my job to take 1 month off, and I come here and this? Oh, no. And you know, and so what I usually like to say is, okay, once in a while, here or there, it's not going to harm you. But you get ladies' holiday, you know, as traditionally called in the Ashtanga method, you know, it's just menstruation time, you're going to get it more than once. So we want to have the right. We want to have the consistency of respecting that flow each month. But once in a while, you have like a, oh my God, this is my one chance to meet the guru, and you know, I think it's okay once in a while to disturb the flow. But you may notice immediate negative impacts, like pain, pain in the muscles, cramps, all sorts of negative things. Okay, it's one time you realize, oh, now I understand ladies' holiday. Sometimes we have to do what we shouldn't to feel it. And also, you know, so I think we can be reasonable human beings. And we can do other activities, but not too strenuous. You know, like you like going for a walk, go for a walk. You know, but maybe not like a level 3 hike, you know? Right? So you bicycle every day, you can still bicycle, but also maybe not mountain biking on that day. Like, you know, we don't need to try to replace the practice.
Another question is that, when you face students jumping out, how long I can make it to do the primary at my best? And there are sometimes the students are pretty rush. It happened in my earlier practice as well. It's very hard. It's not about convincing as a teacher. You don't want to disappoint anybody. Also in the classroom, like, you want to have students, right? You know, like, pay the rent or whatever. So how do we encourage people to stay, to give them motivation?
Yeah.
By providing a simple foundational techniques and an expert. But no, I want to do it. You know, give us a little reference.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. So I think that if someone comes up to you and says, how long for me to master primary series? I think you may want to burst their bubble a little bit and just say, well, I've been practicing for 25 years and I haven't mastered it yet. So I'll let you know as soon as I find out. So you can kind of throw yourself under the bus with that question and be like, well, I haven't done it yet and I've been practicing for this long. Maybe it'll happen faster for you. I don't know. Then you could think about telling them something very simple, which is what Patabi Joyce used to say all the time. You do three things. You do deep breathing. You do mind control. You do drishti. You take these asanas and you use them to feel the body. You do that for many years. How many years? I don't know, but many years. Then the practice will work for you. But we need to be honest from the beginning. We can't be like, oh, give it a week. No. Then they're going to come back a week later and be like, oh, you said a week, you know? I think it's better to say many years because then they come back in 10. You're like, well, you know, another 10. Many, right? And so that we talked about dirgha kalas, many years, you know, so long time. So they come back after 10 years and they're like, oh, I still can't do lotus. Oh, give it another 10. They come back in 20 years, still can't do it. Patabi Joyce used to say some funny things at that moment. Oh, whole lifetime, take practice. Padmasana, not coming for you. You'd be like, oh, so then what? Next lifetime, yoga body, you take it. You know, and then sometimes he would say to us, all you people, not Indian people, you're rushing, rushing, rushing because only one lifetime. So sorry for you, he would say. He said, I'm Indian. Next lifetime, I finish, no problem. Or next lifetime, no problem. You, one lifetime, sorry. So it's also just that zooming out. You know, sometimes when you look at a problem with a really small microscope or like a really tiny lens, and we're obsessed with that problem, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. If you zoom out to 100,000 feet, we're like, actually, it doesn't matter. So that's kind of what he was doing with that of, hey, you know, maybe you never do Padmasana, but still practice. There's something deep happening for you. And if you believe somehow you get one more shot at it, then maybe next lifetime, Padmasana will be a little easier for you. But you never know. You also don't want your dying thought to be like, lotus. You might come back as a flower then. You know what I mean? It's a nice one, but, you know? The preciousness of our human birth is a very large part of the spiritual teaching, so that we have to recognize that this unique opportunity to do the practice has been presented to us, and by grace, we are here. And that we should take what time we have available to us to do the practice. There are no guarantees how long this life will last. There are no guarantees whether we get another shot. We can have faith, absolutely, but we don't know. So we're constantly encouraged to make best use of the time we have on the spiritual practice, because the preciousness, the inherent value of having a human body with all its aches and pains, with all its obstacles, with all the hatred, animosity, fear, and depression that's in there, is the perfect mix for our spiritual awakening. So that we have to acknowledge that and respect this wonderful opportunity we have and the grace that has brought the practice into our lives. And we do that by staying with the practice. So we just keep practicing. Okay, one more, and we have to.
Just a sharing. Speaking of this, remind me, there was a Buddhist metaphor story. There are two guys sitting under a tree, and they both ask the God, like, when will be I enlightened?
Yeah.
And then the God say, like, you look at the trees, the number of the leaves is the numbers of lifetime you're going to be enlightened.
This is a classic yoga story as well. So there's, in the yogic teaching, there are three people, actually. There are three people. And this path to enlightenment is there. So there's three people. And there's one person who's completely not interested in the path. And I think the story is that Krishna walks by and he just says, hi. Hey, how's it going? Hey. How's it going? You met Krishna and you walked away. This is not grace. Something in you wasn't ready. You know, so how many more lifetimes? First, you need to say yes, and then it starts. Then there's a second person who's a dedicated yogi, and he's sitting there with intensive practice, 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 practice. He sees Krishna. Krishna! Oh, Krishna! Oh my God, yes! And then he says, how long for me? And he says, oh, dedicated yogi, you've worked so hard. I think for you, maybe next lifetime. Next lifetime? God damn it! Oh, what have I done? This whole thing is horrible. He gets really mad. He's upset. And he storms off. Forget it. Horrible. Mad. Then Krishna walks by and he sees someone dancing under the tree. And this is the idea, is that he's a bhakta. And he's in this state of love and grace, really. And then he says, oh, Krishna, what my grace and good fortune to meet you. I heard this yogi asked for how long to achieve enlightenment. I think I shouldn't even ask, but let me ask since you're here. And Krishna says, my bhakta dancing under the tree, so nice to see you. Can you see the leaves of the tree? Yes, I can see the leaves. Can you count them? Yes, I can count them. Oh, this is how many more lives you have to attain enlightenment. At which point the bhakta says, thank you, Krishna. At least it has an end. Thank you, Krishna. It has an end. And at this point, through the grace of the guru, Krishna says, come with me already now. You know, this is the yogi version of that. I think that these stories come from, you know, the ancient times of India. So they filter into yoga and Buddhism, same. You know? Yeah. So we should strive to be the bhakta, right? But how often we are the yogi, you know, right? We're very often like, I've been working in this leg behind the head for like 10 years. It's horrible, horrible, terrible. And we're like, next lifetime. I'm just going to be happy about that real quick. Forget that. Let me try to do pigeon. You know what I mean? We should try to be the bhakta, but very often we're the yogi.
Hey there, it's Kino here. I just wanted to thank you for tuning in to my podcast. Your support and your time and your attention really mean a lot to me. If you're enjoying this podcast series, you can find the full-length videos on my online channel, OMSTARS, and that's at www.omstars.com. You can redeem a 14-day free trial and get access to our full library of over 3,000 classes and also practice yoga with me online. I'd also love to see you in class sometime, so you can find my full live in-person teaching schedule on my website, which is kinoyoga.com. And if you haven't checked out my books, I'd absolutely be honored if you'd check those out. You can find those available at any online bookseller. The Yoga Inspiration Podcast is designed to keep you inspired to get on the mat. And I hope you're leaving each episode with a little glimmer and spark of the spirit, which is the true heart of the yoga method. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be filled with love. Namaste.